I don't think today's session is following on at all from what myself and Venerable Upekkha taught recently, because I think we both taught from the Bhikkhuni Samyutta, and I'm not sure what she taught exactly or how far you got, because I wasn't there. Hopefully that was interesting and inspiring and nice to see her again. But today I want to kind of follow on from something I was teaching last weekend, which is why I wasn't here last Friday, which was the theme of samatha and vipassana. And I was leading a training session for people who are going to be what they call community Dhamma leaders, which means that they are sort of qualified through, I think, a two-year program to offer like meditation groups in the community, not to teach retreats, but to have enough maturity of their practice and willingness to learn along the way to be able to hold the space for others. And so we talked about the differences, the relationship between the two, the felt experience of samatha and vipassana. Of course, I'm going to define this as well. And I guess I tried to broaden it out by showing how they fit into the gradual training, because actually the Buddha far more often taught the gradual training as an approach to practice than he did particular meditation methods. And these days, the idea of samatha and vipassana have been reduced sometimes in some traditions to symbolize or signify meditation techniques, which is not actually how the Buddha described samatha and vipassana. Firstly, he spoke about them almost invariably as a pair. Yeah. And there's a lovely book that I would very much recommend you read if you haven't already, or if you have, read again, called The Swift Pair of Messengers by Bhante Sajjato. And I do believe that my co-host might be able to find that online if they look, because it is for free download. So I was referring to this a lot while I was doing this training for this group. And I found it really, really insightful and very rich with sutta references throughout. So the title of that little book is taken from a particular sutta, and I wanted to go to the sutta today and read out the simile that is given, which includes both samatha and vipassana. Perhaps before I begin, I should define them. Would that be helpful for anyone who's unclear? So generally speaking, samatha is used to refer to the quality of mind which is calm, or let's say, the effect of calming, of steadying, of unifying, stilling, and pacifying. And sometimes samatha is actually used to mean cessation. Sabbe samatha. Is it? Sabbe sankara samatha. Sabbe sankara samatha means it's a designation for nibbana, and it means the stilling or the ceasing, the pacifying of all formations, of all conditions. Yeah, so samatha is this process, or if you like, an emotional quality of mind that leads to stillness, and it can actually symbolize the process itself. So we samatha the mind, we calm the mind, we still the mind. Vipassana in the suttas, again, doesn't refer to a meditation technique, but it refers to, in a way, the result of any kind of meditation that works. So vipassana literally means clear seeing, or that aspect of the mind which investigates, which examines, which investigates the bodily and mental activities, but that also draws a conclusion based on insight into something like the Four Noble Truths. So we have the teachings of the Buddha informing the way we are aware, and whatever we investigate, we need to make sense of in a way. And so another aspect of insight is that we draw a conclusion based on the principles of reality. And this is explained also in No, that's not the book, actually, Nikos. No. The book I was, oh, hang on, maybe it is. Yes, it is. I saw the word Brahmavihara and got confused. Yes, I think that's the book in the chat here. So the book, Swift Pair of Messengers, describes this aspect of Vipassana as being the investigation and the drawing of a conclusion as part of the legal kind of approach, part of a legal approach. And interestingly, in the Vinaya, samatha is actually one of the ways of settling disputes. So both of them have a kind of role to play in the settling of disputes and the coming to decisions. So one example of this is like in the Sangha meetings when we get together, we come together in harmony, hopefully, right? So this is an aspect of samatha, like we're harmoniously collected together. And then we bring up certain issues to be discussed, to be examined, and hopefully to be resolved. We talk about these issues, then we try to find a conclusion, right? So this is the wisdom aspect. And then as a result of that examination and the drawing of a conclusion, we resolve the dispute. And that's called the samataing, if you like, to use an English verb, the stilling or the pacifying of disputes. Yeah. And there are six different methods of samatha, adhikarana samatha, six different types. Don't ask me to remember them, but one of them is called covering things over with grass, which really means maybe it's not possible to resolve, but we just let it lie. We just let it be. We say, okay, let's move on from this in harmony. So, and it's the same in our meditation. This is not meant to be a Dhamma talk, but it's the same in our meditation in the sense that these two qualities, these two aspects of the mind work together and they are mutually reinforcing. So, you know, we sit down perhaps by starting to come in contact with the body and just settle some of the senses. So we settle the sense of sight. You know, usually we're in a fairly quiet place, so the sense of hearing calms down. There's not a lot to taste or to smell most of the time. Then we're more in touch with the physical sensations, but gradually they settle down. And we also use the examining part of the mind to look and inquire as to what's happening in our body and mind. And as we do that, we can also see that sometimes a remedy is needed. So, for example, if we find we're restless, we might look inside our mind, see that there's restlessness and realize, oh, maybe more contentment can lead this restlessness to settle, to calm. So the wisdom works together with the stilling, and as the mind stills, it's able to see more clearly. Yeah, does this make sense? Excellent. So they are two complementary qualities and they are distinguishable. And yet at the same time, they're usually in union. So anyway, let's get to the sutta, because this is a sutta class, and we can see if we can apply some of this understanding to the sutta and maybe draw something else out too that might not be immediately apparent. So this is from the Salayatana Samyutta, which is a book on the six sense bases. And that is Samyutta Nikaya number 35, chapter 35. And the exact sutta is number 245. It's called the Kimsuka tree. But I'm only reading a part of this sutta, just the section which includes samatha and vipassana as a pair. So we're starting halfway through. Okay, have you got the reference for those who wish to follow? Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 35, sutta 245. Kimsuka tree. Excellent. All right. So I'm reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Might be slightly different from Bhantisajjato, but not very different. Suppose monastics or community, a king or a queen had a frontier city with strong ramparts, walls, and archers, and with six gates. The gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent, and intelligent, one who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. A swift pair of messengers would come from the east and ask the gatekeeper, Where, good person, is the lord of this city? You can see I'm using gender neutral terms as much as I can. That person would reply, they are sitting in the central square. Then the swift pair of messengers would deliver a message of reality to the lord or lordess of the city and leave by the route by which they'd arrived. Similarly, messengers would come from the west, from the north, from the south, deliver their message and leave by the route by which they'd arrived. So I don't know about you, I can never keep all these similes in my mind, but we'll go through it afterwards and pick it apart a bit further. So the Buddha then says, I've made up this simile, monastics or community, in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning here. The city. This is a designation for this body consisting of the four great elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and gruel, subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to breaking apart and to dispersal. So first of all, I have to say that I mentioned this to Ajahn Brahm and he said, my body's not made of boiled rice and gruel, it's made of fish and chips and condensed milk. So it's just an example. But we're basically saying the body is conditioned and therefore it is subject to impermanence and to change and being worn away, rubbed away, breaking apart and dispersal. The six gates, this is a designation for the six internal sense bases, which is why it's in the Salayatana Samyutta, which are eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. They're the six internal sense bases. The gatekeeper. This is a designation for mindfulness. The swift pair of messengers. This is a designation for serenity and insight. So here, that's the translation for Samatha Vipassana. The lord of the city, or lordess. This is a designation for consciousness. The central square. This is a designation for the four great elements, the earth element, the water element. Here it says heat, but it's usually the fire element and the air element. A message of reality. This is a designation for Nibbana. The route by which they had arrived. So this is the route by which Samatha and Vipassana, the swift pair of messengers, had arrived. This is a designation for the Noble Eightfold Path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right livelihood, right action, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right stillness. I hope I got that correct because it just said dot, dot, dot. And I've changed effort to endeavor, which I like, because effort implies some amount of force. Endeavor, to me, refers more to an aim or goal, a purpose, the purpose for which we're working. And right stillness, of course, is Ajahn Brahm's favorite translation for concentration and something I came to myself before I even met him or heard his teachings, which is one of the things that attracted me, because I'd realized through intensive practice in Myanmar that what I was doing was not concentrating. What I was doing was watching the mind get quiet and still and actually expansive rather than confined. So that is the simile that I wanted to talk about today. And maybe I'll just make a few more points, which I kind of noted down, which I think are important here. And the first one I want to mention is that all who attain Nibbana, this message of reality in this case, practice both Samatha and Vipassana. Yeah. Might sound obvious. There's another sutta, Anguttara 4, number 170. And this one talks about, I think this is the one where it talks about how we can begin with one or the other, but basically in the end, we have to develop both. And, you know, in modern kind of meditation circles, sometimes people talk about things like dry insight or dry vipassana without any samatha, or they talk about other people, usually vipassana meditators say, oh, they just practice samatha. But actually, the two have to go together. They're qualities of the mind. Interestingly, in the book by Bhantisarjato, he actually relates samatha to more like the emotional quality of the mind, like purifying our emotional, purifying is a strange word. Yeah, basically, samatha is more like the emotional part of the mind. So that's what it works on. Whereas vipassana works more on the cognitive aspect of the mind, let's say works on. But what's actually discussed in the suttas is that, how does it put it? That samatha can help undermine the defilement of craving, which is an emotional response, craving, aversion, etc. Whereas vipassana is particularly useful for removing any cognitive distortions. Yeah, so undermining avidya, which is a misunderstanding of the way things are, right? So that's quite interesting. I didn't know about that little sutta, which you'll find through Bhikkhusajjato's book. But it does seem they have a slightly different but complementary function. So another thing I wanted to point out from this is the gatekeeper. So here it says the gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent, and intelligent. One who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. And then the Buddha says that this is a designation for mindfulness. I don't know about you, but I find that very interesting because normally we think of the function of, you know, keeping out the negative or afflictive emotions and letting in the positive states, a function of right endeavor, the sixth factor of the path, not right mindfulness. But here, it's talking about that as a function of mindfulness. So mindfulness is not just bare awareness. Mindfulness has a role to play. And one of those roles is to see that wholesome states increase and unwholesome states are abandoned and prevented from coming in. And the other interesting thing here is that the gatekeeper's there first, okay, before the swift pair of messengers come from the east. So samatha and vipassana come and approach the gatekeeper and say, where is the lord of this city? So mindfulness is already there. And this is really important because in a lot of meditation circles, again, mindfulness is almost used in a synonymous way to vipassana. Vipassana is mindfulness of whatever's happening in the body and mind. That is vipassana meditation. But again, vipassana, as the Buddha describes it, is a result of practice. It's actually a result of the whole Eightfold Path, right? So that's why it says here that they came, samatha and vipassana came through, what's the simile here? The messenger would come from the north, south, or east and deliver their message and leave by the route which they'd arrived. And the Buddha said the route that they have arrived is a designation for the Eightfold Path. So samatha and vipassana arrive through the practice of the Eightfold Path. Yeah? In other words, the Eightfold Path is a support, is leading to samatha and vipassana, usually in that order. So the last factor of the Eightfold Path is samadhi. And as a result of samadhi, we're able to perfect and purify right view. So the whole path circles back on itself and begins with the understanding of the stream winner, begins again with the understanding of the stream winner based on samadhi. So I hope this is not too technical. Maybe it's, no? All right, people seem to enjoy. But I would like to open up for some discussion because I was thinking that apart from, analyzing the sutta and trying to understand the simile, this can be very insightful to us for the way that we approach practice. And as I said earlier, more often than a discussion about samatha and vipassana, the Buddha teaches the gradual training. And in the gradual training, most of the time, it begins with establishing a certain amount of confidence in the teachings, purifying our virtue, then undermining the hindrances, the five hindrances, and developing jhana, developing deep samadhi, which is the samadhi is like the state of stillness that arrives as a result of calming the mind through samatha. So samatha is like the process, samadhi is like the state, if you like. So samasamadhi is always described as the four jhanas. And from that place, we have an opportunity to see things as they are. So in one of the suttas that I referred to in my teaching, it was the Samanapalya Sutta. I think that's Digha Nikaya number 2. And in there, there's a lovely simile about what happens after the jhanas. And did I write this down? It says something like, it's just like a mountain pool, which is crystal clear and clean. So this is the mind after samadhi. Just like a mountain pool, crystal clear and clean. A person with good sight, that means vipassana, clear seeing, would be standing on the banks and would be able to see into that water, which is clear and still, would be able to see all the shells and the rocks and the fish swimming in that water or resting. And in the same way, a person who has samatha, who has this clarity and stillness, is able to look into the mind, deep into the mind, and understand the nature of the mind, which also comes up in this sutta, but also understand nibbana. Understand the fact that everything will cease. Okay, so it's time for you to discuss and to ask your questions, and I'm coming to Manoi first of all.
Yeah, so while you're talking, the way I understand Venerable is like, say, not only meditate during meditation, but generally you develop your mindfulness into the level of kind of sati sampajanya, and you know that level, and then you develop your all the samma, like not up to the samadhi but up to the sati, kind of, because you're in the sati sampajanya most of the time, so you know where you are kind of falling off from, and then you can develop. And then when you are on the cushion meditating, then you develop your samatha and vipassana.
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
That's pretty good.
The
That's
order. And yeah. Then I've got a question for you. Like when you kind of talked about vipassana and, the popular vipassana is looking at what is happening in your mind.
Yeah.
But the way I kind of understand here, vipassana, is it that still pool that you are saying, that looking at it? So that means you are so clear, your wisdom is already there and you are seeing it, or do you have to analyze there when you are so clear? What is exactly vipassana?
Okay, wonderful. So is it that your wisdom is there, or is it that you have to analyze it? It's a bit of both. But let me go back into the sequence you described, because there was one part of it which was a little bit missing, and also in my explanation, which is the part between sila and mindfulness and clear comprehension. So there's another link between the two called sense restraint. So that's when we start to develop our virtue to the level of mental virtue. So it's not only having wholesome actions of body and speech, but also learning to use our mind in a way that is skillful. So learning to attend in ways that is, again, that leads to the wholesome states increasing and being maintained. and that protects the mind, guards the mind. That's, I actually prefer the translation, guarding the senses than sense restraint. We guard the mind from any lust, any ill will that could arise by improper attention, basically, by perceiving things in unskillful ways. So, for example, if you know that, you know, you're a bit restless and you're kind of thinking about, I don't know, your old partner or something like this, and then you meet a person and, you know, you're kind of a bit romantic, you're in a romantic mood. I mean, this doesn't happen to me, but it might happen to people. And you look at the person, oh yeah, don't they look attractive, you know, and you're kind of like wanting that kind of experience, right? And so you look at the person and you just focus on the things that increase that feeling of, you know, attraction, or yeah, something that you want to happen in the future perhaps. But a wise way of looking would be more to think, okay, I'm in this mood where I'm a bit lonely, I'm a bit sort of restless, whatever. So if someone attractive turns up, I should be on my guard, you know, and maybe look at this person just like a brother or a sister, and as a fellow human being. So I'm not going to like focus on things that could increase that sense of longing or lust. Yeah, I'm going to look in a different way, in a way that kind of undermines those feelings and that brings about connection. Yeah. And in that way, maybe we could fulfill our feelings of loneliness or whatever. It's just one example. And yeah, then the clear comprehension, mindfulness and clear comprehension in daily life goes hand in hand with that sense restraint, because we don't want to kind of stimulate ourselves to the point where it's really hard to be mindful, right? And the more mindful we are, the more we realize whether we're using our mind skillfully or not. Yeah. Are we looking at the sides of aspects of a person that make us angry, or are we able to kind of see the whole person, see their qualities, see the times that we've appreciated them, you know, the things that their intentions, maybe their intentions are really good. They just have some certain behaviors that are irritating to us. So we look in a different way. Yeah. And then the mindfulness and clear comprehension, or sati sampajanya, in and of itself is not samasati yet. Okay. Samasati comes a bit later when we've started to overcome the hindrances. So the next stage in the gradual training is to start to undermine the hindrances. And this is how we develop our mind into still states. As long as those five hindrances are operating, it's impossible to enter deep samadhi. Yeah. And it's also impossible to see things clearly, which is one of the functions of samadhi, is to overcome those five hindrances so that our mind is clear, so that we can look down into that pond, that clear lake, and we can see things as they are. So the question about whether that happens automatically because wisdom's already there or not, I think depends on whether we've had enough exposure to the Buddha's teachings. In another sutta, which I don't know where it is, it says that the two factors required for stream winning are the work of the mind that goes to the source, which is very strong, clear mindfulness and wisdom, and the word of another, which means you've heard the Buddha's teachings from someone who's experienced them. It might be the Buddha himself in the suttas, or it might be a teacher who's at least representing those teachings well, if not having some experience or even deep experience themselves. So this is, oh, what was I going to say? Something like, there was something else in this sutta that reminded me of that, and I forget now. But yeah, basically we need to have had some exposure to the Buddha's teachings. Yeah, I remember what it was. The simile I gave before about the two functions of vipassana being like a judge or something like this. So a good judge, or someone who wants to examine a case, not only examines it and investigates it, but also draws a correct conclusion based on the principles of the Dhamma. So we have to draw that correct conclusion. And one of the things that goes wrong in people that haven't heard the Buddha's teachings is that they might have deep meditation, their mind might be very clear, but they don't draw the right conclusion. They think that this is now ultimate reality or cosmic consciousness or the eternal peace or heaven or God or something like this. Whereas if we've heard the Buddha's teachings on the Four Noble Truths, you know, we've heard the Buddha's teachings on dukkha, anicca, anatta, then we're likely to actually pick those things up. We're going to see those things. We're going to look in that direction. And that's what Samasati also is about. The four Satipatthanas are to try to get us to look in those areas of existence, like the body, the mind, the mental contents, and the feelings. Try to get us to look in those places, because it's very, in those places we can see dukkha, anicca, and anatta. So it's okay to do this before samadhi too. Samasati usually comes before, but the hindrances, if they're still very strong, you're not likely to see it deep enough to actually gain the liberating insight. Yeah. So that was quite a long answer, wasn't it? Hopefully that was okay. Yeah. Joseph, can I come to you? And please write in the chat as well, if you wish.
Thank you, Venerable. I'm just checking. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay. So I was thinking about focusing. I really appreciate you bringing up working with the mental defilements, trying to purify. So there's wrong view, covetousness, and ill will. And so what you described, I read a sutta that says that the delusion arises from unwise attention, and Yoni Somanisikara brings about the decreasing of delusion. And so greed arises through unwise attention to the sign of the beautiful, Subhanimitta, and yeah, then the unbeautiful. And then Patiga Nimitta is like this irritating sign arises for hatred. So when we unwise attention on the irritating aspects of something.
Yeah.
And the antidote for that is metta citta vimutti. And so I was thinking about, I was finding myself really longing for community.
Mm-hmm.
I was finding myself really craving, really wanting to be in community. And I had this beautiful experience with Bhante Sudaso, where I was telling him about this. And he said, you know, community is just a bunch of people. He says, it's just a bunch of individuals who are constantly changing. And I noticed that something snapped, something switched. And I think it was latching onto the sign of the beautiful community. Once I'm in community, then I'll be safe. And then he made it very clear that you could be in community and it might not be, you might not be as happy as you think in community. And so I just wanted to bring that up as something that was very helpful. What was my intention? My intention is to cultivate, I'd like to purify the mind, like from covetousness. And so I was thinking about, what is the relationship between, say, like, I was thinking about mudita, rejoicing in the happiness of others is maybe a really good, safe place to keep the mind.
Yeah.
How is that avoiding the sign of the nimit of the beautiful, though, in terms of there's metta? So is mudita just another form of metta? It's just all metta citta vimutti?
Probably, yeah. I mean, it's mudita citta vimutti too, but it is a variation on love. It's a variation on love, and it's okay to look for the sign of the beautiful. I mean, I even think in wanting community, it's not an unwholesome wish. The problem with it is that, yeah, if you're pinning your hopes on that to solve all your difficulties and to make you happy, then you're putting conditions before your happiness. You know, you're saying, I'll be happy if, blah, blah, blah. But the actual intention in and of itself is a wholesome wish, you know, especially if it's spiritual community. The problem is that our wishes don't get fulfilled and then we might suffer. And also we put too much stock on things happening a certain way that we wish. And actually, in reality, things happen a completely different way than we wish. And sometimes there's a lot of beauty in that. And if we're only focused on one particular outcome, we only want one particular outcome, we're just blind to the riches that are right before us. You know, we don't actually see the opportunities for growth that we have. So this is the problem there. But it's so interesting that you asked this, because tomorrow I'm actually teaching a retreat called Abandon Hope, Cultivate Joy. And it's exactly about that, about how we have like a particular desire for things to happen a certain way. And because of that, we're kind of sitting around not really taking responsibility. Whereas actually, if we cultivate joy, you know, if we take the responsibility to cultivate joy in our heart, we don't have to wish for happiness. It just comes as a result of cause and effect. So, I don't know if there's some background noise somewhere. It might be.
I mean, I'd be sure.
But don't worry if it is. It's not too loud. Yeah, so the cultivation of metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka, I think as long as we keep in mind that these are not to get a certain outcome, you know, that's why they're unconditional, you do it anyway, no matter what result it produces, no matter who it may or may not help, you do it because you want to overcome the afflictive emotions, let's call them. And mudita is particularly helpful for feeling a sense of lack, a sense of, longing can be one thing. Obviously, jealousy, competition, resentment, miserliness as well. Mudita can be really helpful. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about one beautiful example of a senior monk who came to visit us here. He used to be known as Oxford Sayadaw before the pandemic, but then he went back to Myanmar because he's got so much work to do there. But it's such a beautiful example of someone who is living among suffering, extreme suffering, but he makes his main practice cultivation of sympathetic joy. So he looks for things to rejoice in, other people's goodness, things he can do, things other people are doing. He came here and said, I have much, much metta for all the effort and all the support that's gone into creating this place. And, you know, when someone says it in that way and they've made the effort to come here, it was like his, I think he'd been in the country one day, then he'd taught in Hungary for 3 days, then he came to us the very next day. He made that effort to come, you know, just because he wanted to show his support, but also I think because he wanted to rejoice. And it was so beautiful and so heartfelt. So, yeah, it's a very beautiful quality to develop, and it's usually the third of the Brahma Viharas simply because the other two provide a very good foundation. Mudita is not always easy on its own, but see, you know, different things at different times for different minds.
Is it?
So, yeah, definitely a good thing to do. Okay, I'm gonna. Was that all?
I was just wanting to follow up with when you talk about samatha and vipassana, the mind goes to the Upanisa Sutta.
Yeah.
It says faith is a vital condition for joy. Joy is a vital condition for rapture. Rapture is a vital condition for tranquility. Tranquility is a vital condition for happiness. Happiness is a vital condition for samadhi. Mm-hmm. That would that be that sequence? Would that be samatha? And then from samadhi to truly knowing and seeing, to disenchantment, to dispassion, to liberation and knowledge and vision of liberation? Would that be vipassana?
Okay. So, again, I just want to reiterate that vipassana and samatha always go hand in hand. You know, we want to separate them. We want to kind of say, oh, this is one and this is the other, and it's this one first and then it's the other. There is a difference in emphasis, though. And I do think the first part of that sutta, from confidence to gladness, is based on faith in a sense. Sorry, it's based on wisdom in a sense, because confidence is a certain amount of cognitive understanding. It's based on hearing the Dhamma, getting some kind of, oh, that sounds good, that sounds right, that makes sense, right? So there's some amount of wisdom there already. And then there's going to be some amount of right intention ensuing from that, which is also the wisdom faculty. And that's going to inform the process of samatha. But the process from gladness to stillness, you could say, is mostly describing the process of moving into jhana. So samatha, samathaing the mind. But of course, wisdom is there. If you're going into that going like, right, I'm going to sit down and I'm just going to watch the breath no matter what. I'm going to hold on to it. I need to get the joy. I need to get the joy. Where's the joy? I want joy. Other people have got joy. It's my goal to get into jhana. Then you're not going to get any joy because there's no right intention. There's no wisdom in your approach, right? So, so it's not actually going to work. And the reason it's talking about them being causes for each other is also, you know, pointing to the fact that this is, there's some insight here into cause and effect. It's understanding that one causes the other that allows us to let go. We don't have to do it. There's another sutta, and I don't know if it's the Upanishad. I think it's the volition. There's two that are almost the same, but it basically says one does not need to may gladness arise. If one has the confidence, it's natural that gladness will arise. If gladness arises, one does not need to will, or one does not need to have the volition. May piti arise. It's natural that rapture arises. etc., etc. And yes, you could say that after the samadhi, after the jhanas, it talks about seeing things as they really are is natural. Actually, yeah, fading away of, yeah, what is it? So nibbida viraga nirodha, or nibbida viraga, I think, and yathabhuta jnanadasana. Sorry for the Pali, everybody. I don't want this to be like a Pali class. It basically means kind of the mind becomes sort of disenchanted and wearied and tired and even disgusted with suffering, right? With the realm of suffering. And because of that, it turns away. Let's go. Things start to fade. And then we start to see things as they are more and more deeply. I think it's that way around. It might be the other way, but they all come kind of together, you know. And you could say Vipassana is really taking off at that time. It's like the insight is getting clearer and clearer. But if you lose your samadhi at that time and the hindrances come back in, then the blinkers go on again. So you can't have one without the other. But it's like they're two qualities of the mind that are always there. That's why I quite like this idea that one is your emotional, one is your cognitive aspect, almost like IQ and EQ. I mean, this is Bhantisajato's sort of way of explaining it, and it's one perspective, but I thought it was interesting because I do think one of the reasons Vipassana has been pushed so much in certain conscious societies, political climates, is because the emotional aspect of life, of the mind, of the person, is being sort of denigrated, and the intellectual aspect or the wisdom aspect is being elevated at the expense. And that's not an integrated practice. We need to be purifying our heart as well as our mind, if you like. Of course they go together. Yeah. Is this making sense to people? Yeah. Good. It'd be nice to hear more from people. It doesn't have to be about the sutta. It can be about your own practice. How do you experience samatha vipassana? So we've got, I saw a hand go up here, and there's one in my room as well. Was there a hand on the screen? I lost it. Okay, so I'll come to Caro, who's sitting right here. If you could speak up so everyone can hear, that would be super. Yeah. And then if there's someone else in the Zoom group, please raise your hand again.
Yeah, I have the question about the separation of emotional part and like samatha and cognitive part of vipassana, because I practice vipassana method. for me it was taught like okay, seeing the things, and for me it's also the emotions what I see, like anger and doubt and joy, and for me it's like the emotional part, and I wonder what is meant by the emotional part.
Yeah. So I'm guessing everyone could hear that. So yeah, super duper. So I think it's not that Bhantisajato is saying that you won't be observing both in any methods. You'll be naturally coming in contact with both your physical and mental experience, your emotional and cognitive, which I think is actually much more experiential than cognitive. Like it's felt wisdom, it's embodied wisdom in a sense. Is that what we're developing? But what the suttas do say is that vipassana, samatha, the emphasis of samatha, it's more effective in purifying the emotional defilements. So it's one thing seeing them, it's another thing cultivating them. So I think what samatha has a strength in is actually cultivating positive emotions, which is a little bit different from the emphasis of vipassana, which is more to have a sort of objective, big lens on the whole of experience, and not to favor one over another, one experience over another. It's just to see things kind of as they're arising. The problem with that is that we think we're seeing them as they are, but if the hindrances are there, we're not, right? And also, if we only ever practice cultivating wholesome emotions through samadhi, we might not be able to tolerate unpleasant situations. So in that sense, we do need to develop both. But I think that the distinction there isn't about what you notice in your meditation as much as how each one has a strength in purifying certain aspects of our mind. Yeah. So Vipassana like the result of vipassana is vidya, is like wisdom, right? So that's the opposite of avidya. So its purpose is to destroy delusion, whereas the purpose of samatha is to cultivate like very positive emotional states. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And the two work together. So again, I don't want to be dividing these too much, but they do have a different felt sense, and they have a different effective quality. And yeah, I definitely can distinguish the difference, although I think my former practice was very much a blend of the two. Yeah, more so than the Mahasi method, because we would be developing samadhi all the time by kind of moving through the body in a certain sequence, and it would be very, very calming, actually. To the point where at one point I went to my teacher in Myanmar after practicing this method for like 14 years intensively and 4 years with him, intensively as in all day, every day. And I said, hang on a minute, is what I'm doing actually vipassana, or is it only samatha? And it's called vipassana, right? But I was like, am I sure I'm not just calming the mind? I mean, what is real insight anyway? And you know, he said it was amazing. He said, as long as there's a sense that I am watching, it's only samatha. Mm-hmm. It's not yet at the point of vipassana, and I think that's the case. Mm-hmm. Real vipassana is like the insight into non-self. So it's not a method, although that can lead towards vipassana, but vipassana is not, you know, the insight is not a method. You can't do insight.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a few comments in the chat. It makes a lot of sense. It seems like in the West, sometimes it's promoted to take shortcuts, even in meditation. I mean, my immediate response wants to be a bit cheeky and say, especially in meditation, but that was a bit, but you know, in a way, yes, because in life in general, we're trying to do things quickly, look at AI, et cetera, anything to speed us up and make us work harder, right? And be more productive, except less quality. But we bring that attitude into meditation. And if meditation is deemed as the most important thing in our life, then we take it even more seriously. We want even more results. And I remember Ajahn Sucitto once saying, your meditation is far too important to take seriously. I thought that was really good. Like, don't make it a striving, don't make it miserable, you know, don't start to kind of clamp down on what you expect and what you want to get out of it, because it's really going in the opposite direction from worldly goals. We're here to abandon goals. We're here to develop contentment in the moment, to be present to whatever's arising, and to really learn to let go. So yeah, that's absolutely right that we do it in meditation sometimes, especially if it's that important to us. Yeah, so this is why right intention is absolutely vital to guide and steer our practice. Right intention includes something called avihimsaka, which means gentleness or non-violence. You know, being very, very light, very, very gentle with the process. And of course, the wisdom into the process itself. It is a process. It's not something we do. We can make happen. It happens when causes and effects are in place. In that sense, the desire for community is a very wholesome one, because that's one of the causes, actually, for the practice to take off. Spiritual friends. They don't have to be right around you all the time, but at least you can check in from time to time. Okay, please can you say more about cultivating concentration? It's okay. I'm just teasing you so you won't forget that. It's maybe more skillful to see it as stillness or quietening of the mind, serenity of mind. Okay, but you've qualified it here. Please can you say more about cultivating concentration rather than expansion of mind in relation to Ajahn Brahm's teachings? Thank you. That's a big one. Yeah, he doesn't really use either expression. Concentration is a translation of samasamadhi, and from a felt experience of the process of samatha, it doesn't really fit. It could perhaps fit in terms of the fact that we're becoming more and more immersed in one thing, an object, a single object. The mind is becoming unified in one thing. So to that extent, you could say you're concentrated on it. But I find that the way in is for me, is to include everything, first of all, and allow the mind to just settle on one thing when it's ready. Invite it to, but not necessarily force it to. In fact, I don't force it at all. I'm probably a bit too soft. And the expansion of the mind. So yeah, you could see that as part of the approach, the first approach, you know, and he does teach that. He teaches to be aware of the whole body and to kind of gradually allow the breath in. So the mind is quite soft, it's quite relaxed, it's quite wide. But I think really the expansiveness is more a description of the states of jhana themselves or leading to jhana. Because we can't all get into jhana, but, you know, we can have an understanding of what it's like along the way. So they are called mahagata states, which means the mind gone to greatness. So the mind has become big, great, huge, vast, boundless. And, you know, the Brahma Viharas also are called boundless states, immeasurable states of mind. Yeah. So that's really the Buddha's teachings more than anything. But certainly Ajahn Brahm would describe jhanas in that way. Okay, it seems that in the suttas, the meditations to purify the mind are the recollections of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and virtue. Are these all various forms of mudita meditation? not necessarily. I mean, it's interesting when these questions come because it shows that you're starting to see how all these aspects of Dhamma fall. They kind of come together somehow. They're not particularly separate. It's like a holograph, right? There'll be aspects of, although there could be mudita arising as a result of these practices. But who knows? Maybe your mind goes in that direction, you know, and then it becomes a mudita practice. It's not that these things are delineated and separate. But the practice of mudita as a Brahmavihara is a bit different because we start. I mean, it depends how it's taught, right? In a way, whatever works for you. But the practice of mudita as a Brahmavihara is more like a sort of extension of metta. It's like wishing all beings happiness, but in particular wishing that beings who are happy continue to be happy, you know, rejoicing with them, feeling happy for their happiness. So it's a little bit more specific. But look, they're all skillful means to start to brighten, calm, and energize the mind. And so as long as that's happening and the hindrances are being undermined, all these things lead to samadhi. And the wisdom develops as far as you understand what it is that you're doing and have the right approach. Yeah? Anyone else who hasn't already had a chance to speak? I hope this isn't a bit dense or anything like that. No, good. Well, one person saying no. Yeah. Maybe I can ask all you guys a question. Well, actually, I'm not allowed to say guys. Here we say lasses because we go northern and I'm from the north. So I say, all right, lasses. All right. We got out to say last. Anyway, this is just me being playful. Okay. So I will ask you a question. Okay, someone in the room has a question.
Just a more of a technical question. In the beginning, Manori used the word sati sampajano, and I don't know if everybody knew what this word means. I'm not sure if I know what it means myself.
Yeah. Satisampajanya or satisampajana. Yeah. So the question was about whether people know what that means. It's a kind of Pali term and it's part of the gradual training. So in the gradual training, satisampajanya basically means mindfulness. That's the translation mostly used for sati. Sampajanya is like, I mean, they call it clear comprehension, but it has different aspects to it. One aspect is kind of that you understand the purpose of what you're doing. Another aspect is that you understand the context and you act appropriately to the context. So, I mean, it's a really well-used example, but it's like somebody wants to cross the road, you're very aware that they want to cross the road, but, well, you think they want to cross the road, but maybe they don't want to cross the road. So you help them cross the road and you're very mindful of doing it, but actually they didn't want to cross the road. So the the action was actually not appropriate to the situation. Anyway, it's a bad example. Sati Sampajani. So it's like you have mindfulness, but you also need to know how to use that mindfulness in a way that's appropriate to the situation, to the context, and also with some wisdom. Yeah, so it's the wisdom aspect that guides that mindfulness. And in the gradual training, it's basically taught about knowing that you're walking forward, knowing when you're walking forward, when you're walking backwards, knowing that you're wearing the robes, knowing that you're lying down. So you know what you're doing, but it also implies that you know the purpose of what you're doing. So it says one is mindful with mindfulness and sampajanya when eating or when sleeping. So that means that you know not only that you're eating, but what the appropriate food is for your health. What is the appropriate amount of food to take? When should you stop? Is it appropriate to eat all the food or maybe leave some food for someone else? That kind of thing. And the same with sleep. It's not just knowing that you're sleeping, because actually you're not really aware when you're sleeping, but it's knowing the purpose for which you sleep. So the Buddha would also sleep. And then Mara would come and complain and say, oh, look at you, you lazy layabout. You can't be enlightened. You're sleeping. Look at you nodding and dozing. And the Buddha said, I'm resting the body out of compassion for the world. So we sleep, we rest so that we can continue to serve out of compassion for ourselves and others. So this is Sati Sampajanya in a nutshell. Is that okay? Okay. But it's not Satipatthana yet, which is more like taking that Sati Sampajanya and applying it to the four areas that the Buddha talks about in the Satipatthana. So basically to the body, the nature of the body, to feelings, to mental states, and to mental content. So you apply that initial Sati Sampajanya to these areas and you start to use insight to look at what's going on. The way I understand so far is that both samatha and vipassana are results. Yes, in a way, they're kind of results. Samatha is more like the process. If you would say samadhi and vipassana, I would probably say yes. Samatha is more like the process. Vipassana, yeah, you could talk about it also as like it grows gradually. They are, in a sense, the outcomes of the Eightfold Path. They are the outcomes of any meditation that works. Right? Any meditation should both generate clarity and calm and insight. Any meditation that works should be developing both those qualities. But they're also qualities, you know, they're also qualities of mind that we have all the time. I mean, it's not that we don't have any of these any of the time. We actually have them pretty much all the time. We have a capacity to calm ourselves. And we have a capacity to know what's going on. So they are actually natural qualities of our minds. I had a practice from Tibetan Buddhism of mind training, where you develop your attitude and attention with the awareness of exchanging oneself with others, even on an emotional level. But I felt there wasn't much wisdom like in Vipassana. So now I'm trying to be more aware of the wisdom aspect. Excellent. That's really good. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the wisdom aspect, first of all, would help guide you as to whether this was helpful or not, you know, whether exchanging yourself with another on the emotional level was actually leading to the wholesome states arising or not. That's an aspect of right view. Yeah, and I'm sure you know what to do to be more aware of the wisdom aspect. Sometimes just knowing, you know, how am I being aware? Am I becoming more clear? You know, how am I reacting to this particular practice? This is the wisdom aspect, just being clear about what's going on. A really interesting word is pasidati, which means is bright, is calm, becomes clear. The heart gains passivity. I think the heart is passivity. Passivity must be a verb. I think the heart gains passadi, actually, when it meets someone who is awe-inspiring all around, meaning pure in body and speech, and from time to time gains clarity of mind. This is from the suttas. Yeah, from the five ways to remove resentment. The word passivity seems to support both tranquility and insight with qualities that are calm and bright. I think usually it's used more for sort of tranquility, but of course you're quite right, because we can't separate. The calmer we become, the clearer we become. That's why samatha is good for seeing things as they are. Yeah, excellent. Anything else? We have 5 more minutes from anyone who hasn't yet shared or would like to share. Otherwise, I would like to ask how you experience vipassana and samatha. What is the effective quality? How do you know when the mind is still? How does it feel? How does it feel? Is it? Aha. Come in.
What I've noticed is it's a physical difference. It's almost like an impact on the nervous system.
Yeah.
It's a as if there is a sort of a protective buffer is there. So if something wants to get through the gate, the buffer is also a physical gatekeeper. Mm. It's actually, I don't know whether it has an influence on stress hormones, on probably has on blood pressure, on heart rate. I just find, especially in my stomach, a stillness, a calmness.
Yeah, lovely. Interesting, it's in your stomach, yeah. Maybe that's where you tend to embody emotions.
Yes. So for me, that is a sign.
Mm.
The physical.
Very good. Excellent. Yeah, that's wonderful, because it has to be embodied. You know, practice that isn't embodied is just a kind of a conceptual practice, you know, it's a kind of intellectual pursuit, and that's not what either samatha or vipassana are about. So that's great. And I like that you referred to the protective aspect, because of course, as we
what you've just said, I think I have to be careful that I'm not using this as a tool to regulate.
Why?
Well, if I just leave it as at that, then I wouldn't really explore the full potential of what we are talking about in terms of the Eightfold Path. I'm just saying, oh, it's a tool to regulate my body, my stress levels, which is fair enough.
Well, I think it's necessary.
Use your words. Yes.
Can't bypass that step.
No. No, but not leaving it at that. Well, one can, but I guess what we're saying is there's more to it.
There's a lot of potential.
It's one aspect, yes.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's an important aspect, and I think it's an aspect a lot of people skip.
Right.
You know, because they want to immediately sort of disembody the breath and kind of move into like the realm of concepts and get into their states or whatever the goals are really fast. And I think they are reluctant quite often to work with the messy stuff. And that's so important. You know, we have to feel a sense of comfort, safety, ease, feeling safe in our bodies, first of all, before we can really develop samatha in a really holistic way. So it's very important. And even if that was all you ever did, which is not a small thing, that would be wonderful. And that would anyway lead to deeper meditation in time. The main thing is that you're exposing yourself to the Buddha's teachings, you're hearing these things, you're understanding the potential, and you're getting inspired. That's really important. And then practice will naturally lead on. Or lead in. So thank you for that. I'm going to come to the last couple of questions in the box or comments. And this is really important. I've tended to see Vipassana as being a kind of knowing without words, more direct than the intellectual mind. And that's absolutely true. I mean, if it's just intellectual, that's not, it doesn't deserve the name Vipassana at all. And I think when we're talking about purifying the cognitive or intellectual aspects of the mind, we're just meaning that those things are getting purified, not that it's an intellectual practice. It's, I mean, I don't even really like the word intellectual or cognitive for delusion, because it's something much deeper. It's around view. It's the way we view and understand reality. But it is a kind of cognitive distortion. It's a distortion of perception, thoughts, and view. It's called the vipalasas. These are the things that are aspects of delusion. Distortion of perception, thought, and view. So, but we have to take as our, what do you call it? Like, as our data, we have to take physical and mental reality as our data to understand how we're deluded. So we're inquiring into the bodily and mental activities that we experience as embodied human beings. And that purifies thought, perception and view. Does that make sense? Does samatha mean anything that calms the mind, like watching breathing or mantras or anything? So again, it doesn't mean a technique. So it doesn't mean that breathing or mantras are samatha. But it might be that some methods are more conducive to samatha, increasing samatha, than vipassana. However, both have to be developing together. Does that make sense? So watching the breath, it depends how you watch the breath. And I'm glad you've asked this, because we haven't really got into methods yet. One of the things I discussed with the group was that you can watch the breath in different ways. If you're watching the breath in its basic, most simple form, just as breath coming in, breath going out, and simply knowing that you're breathing in, knowing that you're breathing out, and then allowing the breath to calm, knowing that the breath is calm, you know, then it's more likely to lead to jhanas, like samadhi states, let's say. If you're watching the breath in its ultimate reality, which is not ultimate at all, but anyway, in terms of what it's comprised of, its elements, its air, and you're feeling the vibrations of it, you're feeling the sensations of it, then it's more likely to lead to insights into things like impermanence, and less likely to become a mental object that can lead into states of stillness. So there's different ways of looking at different objects in our mind. And to some extent, it depends on what we're inclined towards. It also can, in other words, how we're made up, whether our mind naturally goes into stillness or into a more analytical approach, or it could be just the way you've been taught, the opportunities you've had to learn the Dhamma. But I like what Charlotte Catherine says. She says that for samatha, you have to just know the bare occurrence of the breath. Bare occurrence of the breath, that the breath is coming in or going out. Which was something I really had to get my head around, I must say, because I was always just aware of the feeling and touch and the nature of the breath. And that would lead to kind of, yes, yeah, some, you can't make claims, and I'm not saying stream winning, okay, so that's the claim, but some deep insights, or some insights that really helped me in my life that felt very profound. So it was different than practicing with the breath as a tool towards jhana, as a means to jhana. Yeah. Now we're getting all the questions. It's always like that, isn't it? Right at the end. It's actually 8 o'clock now. Now you're asking all the questions. It's because you were in samatha, you're in deep stillness, and now the vipassana mind has come on. So now the question. Does samatha mean anything that... Oh, yeah, we've said that. When the mind is still, there are moments of no thought, and when thoughts come, they're not repetitive. It feels wonderful when the mind is calm, and when it's truly calm, there's no one commenting on it being calm. Excellent. Yeah, yeah, that's an example of samatha. And vipassana, because what you've noticed afterwards is that there's no one commenting on it being calm at that time. So that can perhaps, on reflection, provide some insight into non-self. Okay, I'm going to just go to one more, because I think, Joseph, if you don't mind, you've asked quite a few questions today, so I want to end on time. So I'll just go to one more. For me, it's mostly the contrast between the state before and after the meditation. In the moment, I often don't notice lack of stillness. Only after calming down do I realize I was not still before. Excellent. Yeah, that's also a way of gaining insight into what stillness is and isn't. We can also gain insight into what happiness is and isn't. What we thought was happy when we experienced meditation, we realize, oh, that wasn't so happy actually. That was quite coarse. But you only realize that when you have something to compare it to. Okay, I think we've come. No, not at all, Joseph. I just want to end on time. I would love to answer every single question, believe me. And I always try, but I'm also teaching all day tomorrow. So it's not just for you, but for myself. So it's wonderful to ask questions and to have so much love and interest in the Dhamma. It's absolutely wonderful. So thank you all for your attention and contribution and engagement with the teachings. And I am going to still come to Manori, and if you wouldn't mind waiting one or two more minutes so that she can end.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Rinpoche, for that very simple but deep. It's in both ways, isn't it, the topic? And we'll, as Kim said, definitely we'll go to the recording and, you know, listen to that again. And so for a couple of minutes, I thought, as usual, I want to highlight the aspect of Sila that we can use about the generosity. And the generosity helps us the direction that we move on. And it develops the wholesome qualities of the Dhamma practice. So also with the generosity, we can check on ourselves. Do we feel happy giving? Do we feel happy with the donation? Do we feel not happy? Do we have to, you know, improve our qualities? That kind of things as well. So there are a few ways of donating to Anukampa while cultivating the generosity. There can be a one-time donation, any amount. You can do with a bank transfer, PayPal, or SumUp. You can do regular donation as some of you are doing, standing orders. And you can also do volunteering. And also if you are good in some kind of an aspect in volunteering, please email team@anukampa.org. Organizing events is a big need that we have in the long term. And also providing the meals to the monastics. You can do either in person, you can do remotely, you can do deliveries. There, if you contact the team@anukampa.org, you can you can book the supermarket deliveries, which is quite helpful. Sending groceries and other household items. There is a needed item list as well. So there are so many different ways, financial, non-financial, both ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Manori. So we'll still have Ajahn Brahm's tour registry. So if anyone can come to that, you're very welcome. What else? So I'm teaching tomorrow in Oxford. I guess most of you are not in Oxford, but I think there's an opportunity to join online. I think you mentioned shopping deliveries is one of the things that's needed at this time. And also we're starting to build little cooties. So if anyone wants to contribute to that, and in the long run, we'll have an office project as well. And thank you for your engagement again with the teachings. It's wonderful to be here together. And I think I will be back next week. Is that right? And also for the Metta practice next Saturday. So good night, everybody. You can unmute if you wish, and we can wave goodbye.